confided that she was being troubled by terrible dreams of supernatural origin. They discovered the truth about the demon murders in Connecticut. Local and federal police knew about the Warrens, too. Lorraine's psychic powers had often helped them solve crimes, leading authorities to grisly burial sites, and many times pointing to the murderer as well. Lorraine once had a perfectly clear vision of a murderer and helped the police sketch out the man's face, says the television producer. Eventually, they apprehended him. This was after the police had pretty much abandoned hope of ever catching the man. For nearly 40 years, the Warrens have investigated thousands of manifestations of the spirit world, from hauntings and poltergeists to demon murders and possessions. Ed is the director of the New England Society for Psychic Research. Lorraine is a gifted medium whose ESP had been rated far above normal in tests conducted at UCLA. The Warrens estimate that they have investigated more than 3,000 cases of supernatural phenomena, including 42 exorcisms. Together, they were the chief investigators of the Long Island, New York haunting popularized as the Amityville Horror, and Ed was one of the few people authorized to view the original files on which The Exorcist was based. Lecturers, consultants, and authors of a nationally syndicated column, the Warrens have also taught a number of popular classes on demonology and the paranormal. What surprises most people about the Warrens is how sensible, intelligent, and charming they are. Ed is big and rangy, obviously a man who can take care of himself in tight situations, and Lorraine is a lovely, soft-spoken woman with a gentle sense of humor about herself. Someday I hope to have a house as nice as Ed and Lorraine's, and I hope I can appreciate it as much as they do, too, says the TV producer. They're very relaxed people, and you can tell that they're very spiritual, too, but they don't make a big thing of it. Being spiritual is just a normal part of their lives. These qualities are all the more exceptional considering how often their work with the spirit realm has placed their lives in jeopardy. Many times they have found themselves trapped in dangerous situations. Many times they have been forced to abandon people whom authorities of all kinds, governmental, medical, and religious, have also refused to help. Ed's interest in the paranormal dates back to childhood, when the house he was raised in proved to be haunted. He witnessed objects flying around his house, and he even saw apparitions. Lorraine's experience with the paranormal also began at an early age. As a girl, she saw lights around people's heads. Later, she understood these lights to be auras. She had a similar experience when she met Ed.
The night I was introduced to him, I saw a 16-year-old athletic young man standing in front of me. But then I flashed forward, glimpsed the future, and saw a heavier, graying man, and I knew this was Ed at a future date. I also knew that I would spend my entire life with him.
Ed and Lorraine met during World War II. Ed went to art school, while Lorraine was a self-taught artist. They were married during one of Ed's leaves from the military. Their daughter Judy was born while Ed was still in the service. Later they traveled around the countryside in a 1933 Chevrolet Daisy, with a German shepherd dog riding in the back seat. They supported themselves by selling paintings. They both laugh about this today.
"We like to think of ourselves as the first hippies," Ed notes.
But our interest in hauntings and demonology remained constant. We traveled all over New England. Whenever we heard of something peculiar happening, we'd drive over there and investigate, Lorraine says.
Over the years, we gathered a reputation as very serious students of such occurrences. Through all our exposure to demons, we also began to learn how to deal with them, Ed points out.
The Warrens soon were being treated as world-class demonologists, serious and dedicated students of the occult. The TV producer observes,
"The Warrens are really a hot ticket. They're not only bright and interesting, they're very articulate. They make great TV guests, and they're constantly in demand for just that reason. Plus, and this is very important, they're credible people. When they tell you something, you know it really happened, and that they've used all their considerable talents to prove that it really happened. In other words, they're honest people."
3 books have been written about the Warrens: Deliver Us from Evil by Gerald Sawyer, The Devil in Connecticut, and The Demonologist by Gerald Brittle. The couple also figured prominently in The Haunted, the book about a terrifying, ongoing example of demonic infestation.
Many of their most celebrated cases were chronicled in the recent book Ghost Hunters. In addition, two television shows have been based on their cases, and a feature film is now in progress. The Warrens state, "We have a single message we want to get across to the public, that there is a demonic underworld, and that on some occasions it can be a terrifying problem for people." On the day Bill Ramsey was released from the hospital, after the producer had left, Lorraine went into her study and opened the day's mail, something she hadn't gotten around to doing because of the extensive but enjoyable interview. The Warrens hear constantly from people around the world, usually troubled people. This day's mail was no different. A man in Nevada felt that the house he'd recently purchased was haunted. A woman in New Hampshire was troubled by the suddenly curious behavior of her teenaged daughter. And a man in Italy wanted to know if the Warrens could help him break his wife of her long addiction to the Ouija board. The man had read that the Warrens regard such tools as little more than invitations to satanic forces. His wife was getting more and more hooked. Also in this day's mail was a book on supernatural forces. Writers and publishers alike send the Warrens books to get their opinions, and sometimes to ask for endorsements. Lorraine picked it up, and her finger seemed automatically to part the pages right at a chapter called The History of Werewolf. Lorraine recalls, "I'm not even sure why, but I took the book over to the sofa and sat down and turned on the reading lamp, and an hour later found myself still completely engrossed. I didn't know at the time how valuable that chapter would later prove when we met Bill Ramsey. But I really couldn't stop reading. The chapter had fascinating information to impart. The origin of the werewolf superstition is lost in antiquity. It may have begun, as scholars of the supernatural, Sabine Berengould and Montague Summers believe, with those primitive tribes of man who practiced the rites of cannibalism. Evolution brought about a gradual civilizing of these tribes, or of splinter groups among them, and led to both the abolition of cannibalistic practices and a fear and loathing of their brothers, who continued to consume human flesh. The man-eaters were then considered to have the souls of animals, predators, and the predator most universally reviled. The eternal symbol of ferocity and inordinate evil appetite, hard by which rides cruel, devouring lust, as Summers writes in his classic study, The Werewolf, has always been the wolf. With the passage of centuries, this fear and hatred developed into superstition. The cannibals not only had the souls of wolves, they were actually able, through magic or witchcraft, to turn themselves into beasts in order to satisfy their bloodlust. The ancient Greeks were the first to give the superstition a name, one of the two by which we know it today, lycanthropy, from the Greek word leukos, wolf, and anthropos, man. The physical transformation of man into animal, or in modern medical parlance, the psychotic delusion that one is able to effect such a transformation. The second term by which we know this phenomenon, of course, is werism, which derives from were, the Old English word for man. The legend exists in every country and every culture. In those places where there are no wolves, such as Africa, the belief is in were-tigers, were-leopards, were-bears, whatever are the most savage and feared predators. The myth of the werewolf is particularly strong in Scandinavia and in southern and eastern Europe. Most of our modern lore comes from Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia. Stories of the Vlachowlach, the werewolf, have been told and retold for centuries by the wandering gypsy tribes of these regions, most notably those from the Carpathian Mountains. Ed came in later and asked Lorraine what she was doing. She started telling him, and there began an engrossing conversation that lasted until Johnny Carson came on the air, when Lorraine made some popcorn and they watched the comedian together until bedtime. This was the last time they'd be able to relax for some time. Ahead of them, a mere 2 days away, was another flight to England, a place the Warrens had long regarded as their second home. What Lorraine couldn't know this night was how important the chapter on werewolves would later become. She took the book to bed with her that night. An hour later, Ed leaned over and gently lifted the book from her chest. She'd fallen asleep reading. He kissed her tenderly on the forehead and turned off the light. London town.
England has always had a lively interest in the paranormal and the occult. If you doubt it, read any British writer from Shakespeare to William Blake to Robert Graves. This is just one of the reasons Ed and Lorraine Warren always feel welcomed here. They also feel that England is a treasure trove for the serious demonologist. Ed says,
I can't tell you how many empty churches we've entered at night, how many old manor homes, how many libraries where we've had occult encounters.
Lorraine adds, we've even gone walking on the moors late at night, and believe me, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had a good reason for setting his Hound of the Bakersvilles in a place like that. Near midnight, walking on the moors, the fog can get so thick you almost feel you've passed over to the other realm. Everything is very distant. Noises, lights, traffic sounds, as if you're in a cocoon. On several visits to England, Ed and I have worked on cases that involved the moors, and I must say that every time we've done it, I've always been a little bit apprehensive. The moors can be terrifying late at night.
Of course, the Warrens find English haunts to be very friendly, too. As Lorraine has related,
we once stayed in a bed and breakfast where the woman who owned the place told us all about the ghost who stayed on the third floor. The ghost was a woman from the 18th century, and apparently made very pleasant company from what the owner said. That's an important point. Not everything we do involves shrieking ghouls. At least, occasionally, you find that being a demonologist has real rewards. We don't have any doubts about an afterlife, for example, because we frequently encounter it. Being demonologists tends to make you very religious, especially in a country like England, where there's such an honorable tradition of demonology. People sometimes associate England only with Aleister Crowley and the practice of the black arts, but they forget that England is the birthplace of many gifted psychics and students of the paranormal. London was, as always, a perfect combination of the old and new. The Warrens spent their first day visiting some of their favorite sites, from Trafalgar Square to the Houses of Parliament, and, on the second, they went right to work on a particularly difficult case involving a 16-year-old girl who had not spoken for the past year. She and a friend had been following the instructions of a heavy metal rock band by keeping time with Satan, by using various devices, such as satanic cards and incantations, to invite Satan into their lives. Unfortunately, even if the girls didn't take the lyrics seriously, some demonic force loose in the universe did. Nobody, including the battery of psychiatrists who had examined the girl, could explain what was wrong with her. Ultimately, the Warrens spent the better part of an afternoon with the girl, sitting in the family living room with her and listening to her parents anxiously tell them about their lives over the course of the past 12 months. Lorraine asked the mother if the girl kept any occult paraphernalia in her room. The mother looked shocked. Of course not, she said, but the mother looked embarrassed, as if she'd suspected all along that her daughter's problem stemmed from the dark forces. The family friend who'd invited the Warrens over suspected this, too. But then Ed asked if they could go upstairs and look through the girl's room. The parents seemed apprehensive, but eventually they agreed. The Warrens had been upstairs only 10 minutes when Lorraine checked under the bed and found a Ouija board. The girl had continued her relationship with the dark forces all along. No wonder the forces had such control of her. Visibly upset when shown the board, the parents thanked the Warrens and promised to keep close watch on the girl. The Warrens still hear from the parents. The girl has broken her bonds with the dark forces and is now in secretarial school and leading a normal life. The next day, the Warrens set to work on a series of radio and television interviews. The British press is generally much tougher on newsmakers than its American counterpart. Not even American reporters would ask some of the rude, angry questions that come out of the mouths of the Fleet Street mob. It is a testament to their own self-belief that the Warrens have always been treated charitably by British reporters and have been welcomed back to any show on which they have ever appeared.
While the Warrens were promoting a book of theirs, then current, they were mostly using the interview shows to reach more and more people with the same message. Paranormal phenomena occur every day of our lives. Don't be ashamed or afraid to speak up if such an event takes place in your life. Contact the proper people, and help will be on its way. The Warrens had a wonderful 9-day stay in England, seeing old friends and making new ones, and then had to rush back to the States to deal with the case that would be called Killer in the Mist. In this case, a man's face haunted Lorraine's dreams. 6 months later, Lorraine would help guide police to this man, who ultimately would be arrested for the vicious murder of a young mother. A Face on the TV. Bill Ramsey's life seemed to divide neatly in two. There was the life he led up to the time he was placed in the mental hospital, and there was his life after. Bill remembers, "People looked at me differently following my overnight stay in Runwell Hospital. They still liked me and cared about me, of course, but now I was different in their eyes. Attacking the nurse was something they just couldn't understand. And neither could I, as far as that went. And so now I was a new Bill Ramsey. While they weren't afraid of me exactly, I could feel them keeping their distance. Thank God, my family understood me and stood by me and didn't treat me as different. But some of my friends and co-workers." Each society produces pariahs, people who are not welcome there. Bill was beginning to understand what being a pariah meant. Bill became increasingly aware of people watching him, studying him, really, and talking about him when he left a room, or just as he was about to enter a room. One day he was totally crushed when he overheard two co-workers making jokes about him. Children especially began showing fear of him. Obviously their parents had whispered dark and dire things to them about Bill, and the children responded by showing real terror whenever he came down the street. On the surface, Bill's daily life was the same. He worked, he spent time with his family, he dreamed the dreams of all hard-working, proud men. Yet he had a secret fear, too. He was afraid that he would never again be perceived as normal by his fellows. And he was afraid, desperately afraid, that the wolf syndrome would once again be manifested. He kept a tablet and pencil on his nightstand. As soon as he woke up for any reason, he hurriedly scribbled down what he'd been dreaming. He monitored his scribblings in the morning, looking for any evidence that the wolf was again showing itself in the realm of dreams. Thankfully, and he thanked God every day, he found none. He learned to bear the secret pain shared by all outcasts, the smirks and scorn of others that scar the soul, in hopes that someday everything would be right again. One Tuesday early in the next year after the incident, Bill got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. Finished, he started back down the hall to the bedroom when he heard the faint noise of the television in the living room. One of the kids must have fallen asleep on the couch, gotten up and gone to bed, and left the set on. Sleepily, Bill walked back down the hall to the living room and went over to the set. There on the late movie was the black-and-white image of Lon Chaney in one of the old Universal movies, The Wolfman. Terrified that this might be an omen of some kind, Bill reached out to snap off the set. Yet, just before his fingers reached the knob, they stopped. As Larry Talbot, Chaney began telling the gypsy woman that he was cursed, and that he prayed to God that he could find some way to be uncursed. Bill watched this scene as another might watch Hamlet or any other great tragedy. Larry Talbot had not asked to be hexed into becoming a werewolf, yet he had been, and now his whole life was destroyed. The gypsy woman looked at him with her solemn gaze and shook her head. No, nothing could be done. It was too late. Larry Talbot was forever cursed. Bill violently snapped off the set and returned to his bedroom. He lay awake, brooding, until dawn, when he rose, had his breakfast, and went to work. Uncontrollable. Bill frequently visited his widowed mother's home. The two of them liked to sip tea together and talk about pastimes, when his father had been alive, and when the world had seemed a simpler and better place in which to live. Bill always felt good after seeing his mother, and so, leaving there on the night of January 28, 1984, Bill was in a relaxed mood. But minutes after Bill got into his car and began driving through a light snow on his way home, his mood changed abruptly. With no warning whatsoever, he felt another attack coming over him. His body temperature dropped. He felt his jawline tighten as if his face were becoming elongated somehow, and images of wolves began to play in front of his eyes. He slammed his fist against the steering wheel several times, trying to stop what was obviously overtaking him. But no matter what he did, he could not stop the overwhelming feeling of rage and a need for violence that was overtaking him. He knew there was only one thing he could do. He drove as fast as the slippery roads would allow to the hospital.
"Just please have a seat over there."
The nurse was young and pretty. Obviously, she thought Bill was drunk or crazy. Frantically, she looked around for some backup help. The emergency room lobby was empty. She'd have to go find somebody.
"Please, you don't understand," Bill said.
There was a sick, pleading tone to his voice. He knew he was very near the brink of violence.
"Perhaps a cup of coffee, sir, while I go get a doctor."
Bill didn't blame the young nurse. He knew his babbling about wolves and about being overtaken by some other power only served to confirm the nurse's suspicion that he was crazy. But he had to make her understand that he had come here on very serious and urgent business. Not wanting to, but unable to stop himself, Bill reached out with a hand that had now curled into a claw and knocked the nurse across the room. She smashed into a row of chairs, falling over them and slamming into the wall. She screamed for help. Two patients who had been around the corner came running into the lobby, saw the nurse thrown across the chairs, and saw Bill standing in the center of the lobby looking fierce and dangerous. To their credit, both patients proved brave. They moved toward Bill and tried to subdue him before he could hurt the young nurse any more. But Bill was in no mood to be subdued. As the men approached him, Bill leapt at them, hurling one into the same chairs that had felled the nurse, and the other into the reception desk. Now it was the men who were screaming. But now, the nurse had gathered herself enough to grab a wall telephone and call for emergency help. But Bill wasn't going to wait around for more men to try and capture him. A growl rising up in his chest, Bill took off running down the corridor deeper into the hospital. It could only be called a rampage. Anything that got in his way, Bill picked up and hurled into the wall. Chairs, tables, gurneys, even a doctor who was just coming out of a ward, checking over a clipboard. He saw Bill and instantly appraised his condition. Clearly afraid that Bill was going to go into the ward, the doctor set himself in front of the doorway. But that didn't deter Bill. He seized the doctor by the shoulders, lifted him at least a foot off the floor, and then hurled him into the wall. By now, emergency tones were sounded over the hospital speakers. The police had been summoned and were running through the halls looking for Bill. Bill's rampage continued. He went into an empty ward and demolished much of the furniture in a blinding frenzy. He ran down deep steps to the basement, only to find no way out. By now he could hear the police calling to each other as their frantic search continued. His rage was unsated. He ran back up the steps and down a long corridor. He saw a lounge where a few interns and nurses were having coffee. He stood in the door snarling at them. The doctors got up carefully from their seats and started for him. Bill went into the room after them, again, smashing furniture as he moved forward. More screaming. More shouting. He grabbed an intern by the throat and was starting to choke the man when the police burst into the room. Bill dropped the intern, whirling to meet his would-be captors. The police were wary of Bill. There were four officers, and they formed a semicircle around him, moving slowly, carefully toward him. Even with their clubs, it was clear that they were afraid of this snarling, growling man, whose whole demeanor could only be called wolf-like, who crouched before them now, obviously ready to do them great harm. There was a window behind Bill. He thought of smashing it open and diving out of it to freedom. But time had run out. The police officers, their hands clutching their clubs, were coming closer. Closer. And now they made their move. All four of them jumped Bill simultaneously, grabbing him around the neck and torso and trying to subdue him. but they didn't find that so easy. Bill got one of the officers by the hair and arm and threw him to the floor. The man was hurled so violently against the parquet that he would remain hospitalized for 4 days. By then, the remaining 3 officers had no intention of becoming casualties themselves. With fists, clubs, elbows, and feet, they got Bill to the floor and incapacitated him. Finally, they got cuffs on his wrists. By this time, the wolf attack was beginning to fade. Bill felt normal again. He looked around at the debris of the lounge, looked at the frightened and angry faces of the police, looked at the cuffs on his hands, and knew with terrible sorrow and fear that he'd just gone through another episode. Shame, fear, confusion stayed with Bill as the police led him from the hospital. Doctors, nurses, patients standing in the corridors to get a look at the so-called wolf man who had just done great damage to the hospital and some of its people, and into the back of the police car. He thought, "My God, what is ever going to become of me?" Jail. Jail, any jail, can best be characterized in a single word: grief. Anybody who's spent even a few hours behind bars knows that jail is filled with men who've lost all hope, who've given themselves over to grief. The remorseful alcoholic who hangs himself in his cell, the bully who bashes in the faces of those he sees as lessers, the man who cries every night in his sleep. These are the men you meet in jail. Following his rampage in the hospital, Bill Ramsey was restrained and brought in the back of a police car, sitting between 2 burly officers, to Southend Jail. On his way there, he tried to explain to the officers what had happened to him, that he'd really meant no harm, and that he'd really had no control over his attacks, but they had only smirks and disinterest to offer him. He assumed they'd probably written him off as a troublesome drunk. Inside the jail itself, the officers he dealt with were even more grim. He sat in a small room and answered questions for nearly half an hour. He found himself trembling and afraid he would break down and start crying. Several times he asked the man questioning him if he could call Abby, but the officer always said that would come later. When the man was finished with him, Bill was led down a narrow corridor to a holding cell where he was relieved of his shoes and belt. The cell door was closed on him with terrifying finality. He felt as if he were in a cage and would never be free again. During the next half hour, Bill had time to absorb the sights and sounds of the jail. He watched prisoners being taken past in handcuffs, mostly young men with sorrow and violence in their gaze. They were being marched to cells elsewhere in the jail. All Bill could do was pray that he would not have to spend the night here. After a time, a different officer appeared. He came up to the door and unlocked it.
"Police surgeon wants to see you," he said.
Bill could see that the man was ready to jump him if necessary. His hand never left the handle of his billy club. After what he'd done at the hospital, Bill couldn't blame him. He supposed he would look at himself as a wild animal, too. The police surgeon.
"You haven't been drinking?"
"No."
"And how do you account for what happened at the hospital?"
"I had a seizure."
"You're epileptic?"
"No."
"What kind of seizure, then?"
Bill put his head down.
"You don't want to talk about it?"
Bill shook his head.
"I don't know how to talk about it. I'm a doctor. I've heard nearly everything."
"Not this you haven't."
"Try me."
So Bill told him. The police surgeon was very good at keeping a poker face. As Bill explained his malady, he watched the doctor's face closely for some kind of sign of belief or disbelief. But the portly, older gentleman with the grandfatherly white hair simply listened. He didn't interrupt Bill at any time, in any way. When Bill was finished, the surgeon said,
"So you've been in Runwell once, eh?"
"Yes."
"How would you feel about going back there?"
"Now?"
"Yes. I think it'd be best. You could spend some time with the doctors and, well, they could help you."
At first, the idea sounded good. Bill liked the idea of escape. No family or friends to face for a while. He could hide out behind the walls of Runwell Mental Hospital. But then he began to recall how people had regarded him the last time he'd put in a brief stay at the place. The eyes that were always watching him, as if he might go berserk at any moment. The smirks that seemed to touch half the faces he knew. The look of suffocating pity in the eyes of those who cared for him. Poor Bill. Poor old crazy Bill. And then he knew he couldn't do it. If he went back to Runwell, then everybody would know for certain that he was insane. And then the whispers about him would never stop. How could he face his co-workers? How could Abby face her friends? How could the children face their schoolmates?
"Something's wrong with me," Bill said. "That's obvious."
"No.
I mean something that's not ordinary.
Delusional."
"What?"
"You don't seem to be psychotic, not from the few brief tests I gave you tonight anyway, but you certainly do seem to be delusional."
Bill looked right at the police surgeon and said,
"I can't go back to Runwell, I'm afraid."
"Why not?"
"Because of what my friends will say about me."
"What will they say?"
"That I'm insane."
"Lots of people go to mental hospitals who aren't insane. Hell, every person on this planet should check into a mental hospital at least once or twice in the course of his life. There shouldn't be any stigma about going there."
"But there is."
The police surgeon sat down and lit a cigarette, tossing his pack to Bill. Grateful for the smoke, Bill lit up.
"You've got a problem, my friend,"
the police surgeon said.
"I know.
And I don't think it's going to go away."
"I suppose not."
"And I'll tell you something."
"What?"
"The next time you come back here, I'm not going to give you any choice in the matter."
The police surgeon's eyes showed anger now.
"You'll be going to Runwell whether you think it's a good idea or not."
Bill felt terrible, knowing he probably should put himself into the hospital on a voluntary basis now, but...
"Do you understand, Bill?"
"Yes."
"Go on, then."
Bill could scarcely believe what the man was saying.
"I'm free to go?"
"Yes."
He knew he'd disappointed the police surgeon, knew he was probably being foolish by not going to Runwell, but right now his freedom sounded better than anything else. He nodded goodbye to the surgeon, followed a policeman down the hall to a counter where he received his shoes and belt, and was soon enough on his way to the hospital, where he'd left his car. All he knew now was that he desperately wanted to see Abby. Interview with Abby Ramsey. What went through your mind that night when the police telephoned you and said that Bill had had another attack?
I'd been praying so long that it was behind us, and for long periods of time it had been. But now here it was again.
Were you afraid of being alone with Bill?
I wasn't afraid of Bill, but I was afraid of the situation. I didn't think he'd harm me, but the way he was behaving with others, well, I wasn't sure. That was the thing that was difficult for our whole family, trying to understand exactly what was going on. If the problem had been drinking or drugs or something like that, as horrible as those problems are, they're fairly common. You undergo certain kinds of treatment and you get certain kinds of results. But we had no idea what we were dealing with here. A man who was afraid he was turning into a wolf?
Did you ever consider the possibility that Bill was simply insane?
Well, that's the trouble with a situation like ours. Anything was possible. You certainly couldn't rule out that he was simply insane, I suppose, but I guess deep down, I didn't really believe that. Again, I had no idea what was really troubling Bill, but I didn't think we were going to find the answer in anything as simple as insanity.
How was it when Bill came back from the police station that night?
How you might expect. A little awkward at first. Bill was very depressed and obviously ashamed of himself. I made him some tea, and he sat in his favourite chair for a long time, brooding. At first he wasn't able to talk much about it, but gradually we started talking, and sat up until nearly 2 in the morning, going over and over everything that had happened that night. Bill was very afraid of what lay ahead. He wasn't sure he could get up and go to work in the morning. He was afraid he couldn't trust himself any more. You know, he'd been on the job, or walking down the street, or be in a grocery store, and he'd suddenly just attack somebody. He still couldn't remember a lot of it. That's the thing that was the hardest to make our friends understand. When Bill was having one of his attacks, he really lost control. He was barely aware, if he was aware at all, of what he was doing. And afterward there was very little memory of it.
Did you make any resolutions that night?
Not really. We were both drained by what had happened that evening, and we were both very much frightened. I suppose we could have made some kind of resolution, you know, to make sure that Bill never went anywhere at night without me, but we tried to be realistic about it. Bill had to go to his job, had to run errands by himself, had to go visit his mother, things like that. In other words, a healthy, normal life. If I had to follow him around constantly, well, that wouldn't be any way for either of us to live.
So what did you do?
That night, we did the only thing we could. We went to bed and slept. I told Bill that that was the best medicine, plain and simple rest. I'd always wondered if Bill's attacks weren't brought on from fatigue. You know, he usually had a part-time in addition to his regular work, and he was always giving somebody a hand with this or that. He didn't rest much, and I started to wonder if perhaps... But that became a form of madness, too. Always trying to figure out what triggered these attacks in Bill. I even worried that it was maybe something I was doing, something psychological that was damaging Bill somehow. Your mind wanders all over the place at such times. Mine certainly did, anyway.
Did he feel better in the morning?
He felt rested, but he was still clearly depressed and afraid. I didn't envy him having to go to work and face all those people. Most of the people Bill works with are very nice. But you know how people are. I'd be the same way myself. Here's this man who says he's afraid of turning into a wolf, and then he goes and causes a lot of damage in a hospital. What can you make of a man like this? At the least, you're curious about him, and at the worst, you begin to have all sorts of dark suspicions about him. Maybe you're even afraid of him. We certainly had that experience. I could see that every once in a while one of my friends would tense up when Bill was around. I suppose she thought he was going to go crazy and attack her or something. Anyway, as I say, I didn't envy Bill getting up in the morning and having to go out and face all these things.
But he did.
Of course. That's Bill for you. Always the good father and husband. Always the provider. He even managed to make a few jokes about it, though they were more sad than funny.
Did you start worrying every time the phone rang?
Yes, I must confess I did. My stomach would knot up, and sometimes my hand would tremble as I had reached to pick up the receiver.
You prayed?
Constantly, and Bill and the children prayed with me.
Did you relax any as the days went on?
Some, I suppose. But I think both Bill and I were always at least a little bit tense. For one thing, living in a place as small as our town, you're constantly running into reminders of what happened. You look up and see the hospital in the distance, or you see a nurse who was on duty that night, or you see an old friend who looks a little nervous about seeing you. It never really quite leaves your mind. At least it didn't leave my mind, and I'm sure it didn't leave Bill's.
Were you thinking of taking Bill to the doctors or anything?
Bill was afraid that anything we did would lead him back to Runwell, so we thought we'd just continue to pray and lead a good family life and hope for the best.
Do you suppose that was a kind of denial, of not really facing the problem?
Oh, I suppose it was, in a way, but then I also think it was a pretty natural human reaction. We'd already had a lot of trouble. Why put ourselves through more? And who could be sure that it wasn't over? Maybe Bill would never have another attack again, and our lives would be safe and sound once again. That was our hope, anyway.
But life didn't stay safe and sound.
Actually, it did, and for quite a while.
But then the problem was back?
Oh, yes, and worse than ever.
The aftermath. There could be no doubt about it. Following the last attack, Bill Ramsey's life changed considerably. For one thing, there was the scrutiny some of his friends and co-workers applied to him. He felt he was always being evaluated, probed. For another, there was the pressure he put on himself.
Any time he felt so much as a head cold coming on, he feared he might be having another attack. He even monitored his diet. Abby had read a magazine article about how diet often affects mental outlook. Abby now fixed different kinds of meals. Fish instead of red meat. Salads instead of vegetables and heavy sauces. Bill drank mineral water instead of alcohol. The diet approach didn't seem to have much effect one way or the other. His anxiety about having another attack was still great. Fortunately, many months went by without another problem occurring. Gradually, the tension Bill sensed in his co-workers vanished, and he could walk around town again without feeling like a criminal. He'd had a problem. Now it was behind him. He had terrible nightmares, however. The imagery was usually the same. Bill was running down a long, narrow road at dusk. The longer and faster he ran, the less human he looked. Gradually, his upright body became feral, and soon enough he was a timber wolf, streaking along the road. He kept these dreams from Abby. She'd worried enough. One day Bill was going through Anne's room at home. His eldest daughter was a nurse at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. He found several nursing textbooks she'd left behind. Bill began to search through the textbooks, hoping to find the name of a malady that matched his symptoms. As Bill tells it, "I used to sneak into her room when nobody was home. I didn't want anybody to know what I was doing. I was afraid it would upset them. You know, we hadn't had a problem in over a year, so why drag them back through everything again? But I was very curious. I began to spend hours with those textbooks, really poring over them. I even got to be fairly conversant with medical terms, but no matter how long I read, how hard I looked, I couldn't find anything that described my condition. Then one day I came across the term lycanthropy. At first I didn't know what it meant. I read further and saw that it was described as a mental condition in which the patient believes he's a werewolf. I could feel my cheeks heat up. I was embarrassed. Mental condition implied that the patient, namely me, was mentally unsound. I went to the library and read further. I wanted to see if there were any documented cases in which a person had apparently become a wolf, in fact, and not just his imagination. That was the first time I read about Jean-Paul Grenier, who in 1798 stole babies from their buggies and literally devoured them. Sometimes he shared his feast with wolves in the surrounding forests. He'd long ago begun to think of himself as a wolf. I felt violently ill when I first read about this case. Obviously the youth had been insane, but look where his insanity had led him. Not only did he imagine he was a wolf, he acted on it, by rendering the flesh of human infants. I felt a real panic. What if my own problem led in this direction? What if next time, if there was a next time, I not only attacked somebody, but also tried to tear into her with my teeth? I tried to convince myself that this was impossible. I had no conscious desire to do what Jean-Paul Grenier had done. Still, in the coming months, that became my nightmare. One night I would be walking along a dark street and I would see a woman coming toward me in the fog, hear the clicking of her high heels on the sidewalk, and I would no longer be able to control myself. I would attack her and rend her flesh. I never expressed any of these fears to anybody, though sometimes when I passed by Runwell Mental Hospital I thought of how safe it would be in there, my fears under control, my behavior monitored constantly by the staff. But I knew I didn't dare go to Runwell. Only recently had I begun to win back some of the respect I'd lost among my friends. Only recently were people starting to accept me again for the man I used to be. Only recently did I feel that I was a reasonably normal human being again, one who was trustworthy in every respect, despite my nightmares and insecurities. And so, even with the knowledge of Jean-Paul Grenier in the back of my mind, I started to relax. I even tried a few nights out with some of my co-workers, stopping for a pint or two of beer after work, and finding that I was completely under control and just another working man. Nothing special. And then 2 years passed. Abby rarely mentioned my attacks anymore, though one night in bed she leaned over and kissed me gently and said, "We're so lucky." "Yes, we are. We've got such a good family, and we've got our health,
and we don't have any more problems." I didn't have to ask her which problems she had in mind. I kissed her back, stroking her hair and holding her gently. She would always be the love of my life. "It's behind us," I said. We hadn't even mentioned the subject in months.
"You really think so?" she asked.
"Yes. You don't know how happy I am to hear that. It was just a phase I went through. I don't know how else to explain it." She hugged me. For a long time we lay in the darkness there, the way we had when we'd been newlyweds, happy just for each other's company. She fell asleep in my arms that night, and eventually I dozed off too. That night I had the nightmare again, running down a long road at dusk, turning slowly but surely into a wolf as I ran, running toward a huge blood-red moon that lay just behind the gray clouds of dusk. I came awake bathed in a sweat so cold my teeth were literally clacking. I went into the bathroom and found some aspirin. I couldn't stop shaking. I went back to bed and tried to sleep, but I couldn't. I lay there until dawn, until it was time to get up for work. I was exhausted and afraid. I couldn't remember being this frightened in a long time, and I wasn't even sure why. All I knew was that something terrible was going to happen. And soon. An Interlude. The Werewolf Among Us. Both Sabine Beringould and Montague Summers offer numerous accounts of lycanthropy throughout history. Perhaps the most famous and most obscene of these cases, recounted by Beringould in his The Book of Werewolves, is that of Giles de Laval, the Marechal de Retz. Laval, one of the most powerful noblemen in France, was brought to trial in 1440 to answer charges that he was responsible for the disappearance and death of scores of beggar and peasant children. Terrible atrocities involving these children were said to have been performed in the castle of Marchicoul, a gloomy fortress composed of massive towers and surrounded by deep moats. Peasants spoke of nights when a fierce red glare irradiated a casement high up in an isolated tower, and of sharp cries ringing out of it, through the hushed woods, to be answered only by the howl of the wolf as it rose from its lair. During Laval's trial, the testimony of two of his servants revealed that the charges were true. He had murdered not scores, but hundreds upon hundreds of children in an 8-year period, by beheading, strangulation, mutilation, and other hideous means. He experienced intense pleasure in their agonies, Laval stated in his confession, and often bathed in their blood. He was convicted and sent to the gallows, a rather pallid end for one of the most depraved of all human monsters. Beringould's description of Laval at the trial is significant. His hair and mustache were light brown, and his beard was clipped to a point. This beard, which resembled no other beard, was black, but under certain lights it assumed a blue hue, and it was this peculiarity which obtained for Sire de Retz the surname of Bluebeard, a name that was attached to him in popular romance. But on closer examination of the countenance of Giles de Laval, contraction of the muscles of the face, nervous quivering of the mouth, spasmodic twitchings of the brows, and above all, the sinister expression of the eyes, showed that there was something strange and frightful in the man. At intervals, he ground his teeth like a wild beast, preparing to dash upon his prey. A Young Prostitute. Looking back on everything, 19-year-old Lauren Reynolds could not quite recall exactly how her 2-year drift into prostitution had begun. A working-class girl from a small outlying town, she'd come to Southend-on-Sea to work as a secretary in one of the government offices here, but then there had been layoffs, and Lauren had no desire to return to the small town of her youth. She liked Southend-on-Sea, especially since it was only 40 minutes from London, where she spent many of her weekends finding new pubs to prowl and new friends to prowl with her. She tried working in various stores, but none of them paid as well as the government job. At one point, she found herself with 3 part-time jobs, and no hours for herself to meet new friends and go places.
Claudia was the first person to tell her about prostitution. Claudia had always lived by the fiction that she sold cosmetics and was self-employed. Claudia, who was 5 years older than Lauren, always had nice clothes and plenty of spending money. One night, over drinks, when Lauren was worrying aloud that maybe she should go back to her small town and live with her parents, Claudia told her about her real life as a prostitute. Lauren wasn't so much shocked as amazed. She'd always thought of such women as middle-aged slanterns. Not fresh, vivacious sorts like Claudia.
"Why don't you try it?"
Claudia said.
"Me? Oh, no, I couldn't."
Lauren felt herself blushing.
"The first few times it's awkward, I'll admit. But after that..."
The subject didn't come up again for a few more months, when Lauren had become desperate. Even one of her part-time jobs had folded up on her. When she told Claudia this, her friend, smiling knowingly, said,
"Mr. Hammond needs a companion this evening."
"Who?"
"Mr. Hammond. He's an auto parts dealer. He spends a few nights a month with a friend of mine named Monica. But she's got the flu."
"You mean she..."
Claudia laughed.
"Yes, love, that's exactly what she does."
Somehow, 4 or 5 drinks later, Lauren found herself agreeing to meet Mr. Hammond. He wasn't at all what she expected. He was a nice, trim, middle-aged man. He took her to an expensive motel just outside the town and paid for a room with a nice view. As he locked the door and turned to her, Lauren felt her first real panic. Could she actually take her clothes off for a man she didn't know or love? Mr. Hammond made things easier by pouring them both some whiskey. He then began kissing her and petting her, as if they were high school lovers. Mr. Hammond was quite a romantic, and she appreciated that. He told her how pretty her face was, and how sumptuous her body was, and how sweet and nice she seemed. 20 minutes later, the lights out, the sea lapping against the shoreline, Mr. Hammond made love to Lauren. Afterward, he paid her a nice sum of money, kissed her with almost paternal affection on the cheek, and then said he hoped he'd see her again. He took her back to the pub where Claudia had introduced them. Lauren couldn't call this a bad experience, not at all. There had even been a curious sweetness about it. Within a month, after a few more trial experiences, such as the one with Mr. Hammond, Lauren became a full-time prostitute. She vowed she'd never return to her small town again. 2 years later, she thought of all these things as she walked along a dark, rain-lashed street in the warehouse district of Southend-on-Sea. By now, of course, Lauren had lost any innocence she'd ever been able to claim, and had had dozens of experiences with men that could hardly be called sweet. By now, men had tried to do all sorts of foul things to her, and, like most prostitutes, she'd come to see most of them as grunting, selfish, vain pigs. Oh, there were a few customers she liked, such as the shy accountant Mr. Robbins, but for the most part she spent her off hours with girlfriends who were also prostitutes, telling tales about their johns and laughing merrily. Tonight, Lauren was working the red light district. This hadn't been an especially good month. The recession and Margaret Thatcher's tight money policy were still taking their toll on the British economy, and so she'd taken to walking the district, where men liked to cruise and eye the merchandise. This type of pickup had always scared her, because you never knew what somebody might do if he got you in his car. But given her finances, Lauren had little choice. So it was on the streets that same night, just 20 minutes later, that she would have her frightening encounter with Bill Ramsey. The economy having slowed again, Bill found himself once more taking extra jobs, this time with a shop-fitting firm that was doing extensive repairs to a block of apartments in Hornchurch, a medium-sized town about 15 miles from London. Bill liked the job and the people. A lot of time had passed now since his last attack, and his problems had started to fade. Abby and the kids seemed happy, too. On the night of July 22, 1987, Bill took the company van home from Hornchurch so he could drop off his co-workers. He then made the mistake of stopping at the White Horse Inn. It was a hot midnight, and Bill was thirsty from many hours of hard work, so he decided to have a quick pint of beer. But of course he didn't stop there. In an expansive mood, he met some old friends and started drinking in a way he hadn't for at least 2 years. By the time he left, a few hours later, he was admittedly drunk.
and worried about being picked up by a policeman. For this reason, he chose the South End seafront as his driving route. It was the most direct way to his home, and, with luck, at this time of night, there would be little traffic. This particular route, however, took him right through the red light district, and it was there that he developed his strange plan. As Bill later recounted the story, he saw Lauren walking along the street and decided to get her in the van, at which point he would place her under citizen's arrest and take her to the nearby police station. Lauren tells a different version.
"I was walking along the street. It was late and dark, and that always makes me nervous, when I sensed a car cruising along slowly behind me. I turned and saw this van. I could barely make out the man's face. I wondered if he were looking for a woman, but somehow I didn't think so. Not cruising the way he was. He seemed to have something else in mind. You can imagine what it was like, this van staying right on my heels, as it were, and the man inside staring at me. I wondered about running, but then I realized that he could easily hop out of the van and come after me. I kept hoping to see a policeman. A lot of the girls don't especially like cops, but I do. Despite what I choose to do, I've always found policemen very protective and courteous. I wanted to get to the station and feel protected. Then the van surged ahead of me and pulled over to the curb. I didn't know what to do. Maybe this was a man cruising for women after all. Something harmless. I started toward the van. He leaned over and pushed the door open for me. He was a nice-looking man until you watched his eyes. There was something crazed about them. I don't know how else to describe them. He asked me to get in the car. I knew I didn't want to. I turned and started to walk away, but he called me back. Reluctantly, I went. "Yes," I said. "Why don't you get in the car?" "Why?" "Go for a ride." "Where?" "Oh, just around, I suppose." Now he sounded like a customer, a little shy, even coy. I smiled. "What have you got in mind?" "I thank you now." Now, he didn't seem so bad. Even his eyes seemed pretty normal. I smiled again.